In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Reverend Mel White. For something like 30 years, he served the evangelical Christian community in this country in a number of ways, as pastor, as a best-selling author, a prize-winning filmmaker, and also as ghostwriter to some of its most powerful leaders. His clients for ghostwriting included Billy Graham, Jerry Falwell, Ollie North, Pat Robertson. But that relationship changed rather fundamentally about 6 or 7 years ago. In 1993, he was installed as dean of the Cathedral of Hope Metropolitan Community Church in Dallas, Texas, which is the nation's largest gay and lesbian congregation. And at about that time, very publicly, he came out and revealed that he was gay. He published an autobiography in 1994, and he and his story got a lot of attention at that time in the national media. He went on to co-found a group, an organization called Soul Force, which is interested in applying some of the principles of nonviolence that come from Gandhi and Martin Luther King to the issue of seeking justice for the country's lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered individuals. And he is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to talk about stopping violence against sexual gender minorities as part of the Friday Forum series, the series of noontime talks that happen at the University Y, 1001 South Wright, down on the campus. It's sponsored jointly by the Illinois Disciples Foundation, the McKinley Foundation, the Wesley Foundation, and the University Y. And the series has been going on there for a long, long time. There's a series of talks in the spring, the fall, all organized around a particular topic. And over the years, we've had a lot of the speakers here on this show to bring them to a wider audience, to all those people who couldn't go. Of course, if you're interested in hearing his talk, anyone's welcome. It's free and open to the public, and he'll be talking a little bit past noon at the University Y. But we're pleased also to have him here, and we would be happy to have whatever questions you have, comments. All we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so we can accommodate as many different folks as we can and keep things moving along. Do remember, you're sharing the space with the other callers. Be generous with them as we are with you. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For being here. How, just, this is a foolish question, I suppose, just how difficult was this, the split, the break between you and the other folks that you had been working with for such a long time?
I grew up in a wonderful evangelical family where it was assumed that homosexuality was both a sickness and a sin. So naturally, I assumed that as well. So I spent 35 years in therapy, spiritual therapy, psychological and psychiatric therapy, trying to get over this longing for same-sex intimacy and affiliation. So when I finally realized after 35 years of therapy, psychoanalysis, prayer, fasting, exorcism, electric shock, after all those years of struggling, I realized that either I would have to die because I didn't want to carry this burden any longer, or I would have to live as a gay man, accept my sexual orientation as a gift from God and live it with integrity. So all the time I was working for people like Billy Graham and others, I thought they were right about homosexuality. And I was in the closet. I wasn't practicing it. I had a wife and family. Kids were growing. I loved them and I loved my wife, but I had never felt any kind of sexual attraction to her, and that makes it very difficult for a marriage. So when I did come out, and she finally said to me after I tried to kill myself and we got up out of the emergency ward and I was sewn up and the stitches on my wrists were stopped bleeding, she said, "You know, Mel, you're a gay man and you've tried for 35 years not to be. I think you better accept who you are, and I give you that gift of freedom. Just remember, you have a family who loves you." So I moved just down the hill and took care of my kids. We jointly parented them until they were out of high school and college, and we're now very close as a family. And I've been together with my partner, Gary Nixon, for 16 years. Coming out was very complex, but to the family, it was a loving kind of process with hard times and wonderful times. With my Christian colleagues and former employers, it was much more complex. Even though they knew and liked me because of the standards that their churches upheld, they couldn't support me in this, and so they disappeared, most of them, into the woodwork, and that's the last I saw of most of them.
How, as a Christian, how do you deal with those parts of Scripture that are read as condemnation of homosexuality?
Well, I spent 35 years worrying about those six verses, thinking that if I accepted my sexual orientation as a gift from God, that I would lose my salvation and lose my family and lose my career and lose my life and be hated by everyone. So those passages are very near to my heart. I went to theological school, went to seminary, got a doctorate in religion, studied Hebrew and Greek so I could really understand those passages. The closer I got to understanding them, the more I realized that the biblical authors knew nothing of sexual orientation as we understand it today, no more than they knew about nuclear energy or deep freeze. And they assumed that everyone was created heterosexual, that anything that was different from that was sinful. And so when they say in Leviticus 20, a man who sleeps with another man is an abomination and should be killed, it's in the context of a child who sasses his parent is an abomination and should be killed. Or a man who sleeps with his wife when she's menstruating is an abomination and should be killed. These texts have to be seen in their historic and linguistic contexts. And we could spend all this program talking about Romans 1 or Leviticus 20. But I have to tell you, once a person knows in his or her heart that, as the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association say, it's as natural to be gay as it is to be left-handed, that the church just hasn't understood this. Once you understand that the American Medical Association, when it says trying to change a person's sexual orientation is someone who's guilty of medical malpractice, once you see that science and history and personal experience has taught me that I can be a gay man in a loving, gay, committed relationship and serve my church and serve my country, once you know who you are, and once you accept that God loves you, God created you as you are, and God wants you to accept what you are and live it with integrity, then those verses take on another whole context. Now, I don't talk about those verses except to gay people, lesbian people who have been victims of those verses, because people don't really want to talk about them. They don't really want to study them. They just want to use them to support their notion that homosexuality is a sin. Homosexuals can be sinners. I know I am, but not because of my sexual orientation. So, you know, we can talk about each of the individual passages, or we can get over them to some of the important things, like what about all the passages on love that Jesus talked about? What about all the outcasts that he said open wide the doors, and the church now is closing the doors to the outcasts? What about the biblical passage is about doing justice and loving mercy. So for me, the really important thing is to not spend a lot of time arguing about Romans 1, but to look Jesus in the eye and realize he didn't say anything about it, neither did any of the gospel writers, neither did any of the Old Testament prophets. So it couldn't have been too important to them.
Well, let me ask you sort of a little bit of a different question, because it seems to me that there are a lot of people who are uncomfortable with the idea of homosexuality, and that it's possible that some people might indeed, for them it might be a moral issue, and they might say, yes, I think homosexuality is a sin. But I think, and I may be wrong, that for most people, it's why they're uncomfortable with it is not very well defined. I don't know that they would really, how many would say, well, it's because it's a sin, but that they just are, it's something that they're profoundly uncomfortable with in a way that they almost can't tell you why. How does one, if you're interested in changing people's minds or at least getting them to reconsider what they think, how does one approach that sort of vague discomfort that people have with the whole idea?
We have a lot of evidence that says the only way people's minds are changed about homosexuality is to know a homosexual, to know one up close and personal, that the data matters not. whether it's biblical data or the argument about nature or nurture, about whether it's genetic or post-genetic or both, those arguments don't do anything to change people's minds. They just do more to make things uneasy between us. What changes people's minds is knowing a gay man or a lesbian woman, bisexual or transgendered person, knowing them and loving them. That's why when Pat Robertson gets a gay grandchild or a lesbian grandchild, or if Jerry Falwell does, he's going to be hard put to know with what to do with all this rhetoric that he uses against us. So when somebody's uneasy about me, we were on Larry King Live the other day, and somebody called in and said, "What do you guys do in bed?" I think that's one of the things that's at the heart of the unease. They can't picture. A heterosexual finds it hard to picture what a gay person or lesbian person does in bed. And Larry King said, "That's none of your business." And he hung up on him. And I said, "No, that's his business. Let's talk about it." And he said, "This is a network program, Mel. You better be careful." And I said, "No, really. Gary and I have been in the same bed for 16 years. We're like everybody else. We sleep in bed." And Larry King said something that I think is classic answer to your question. He said, "Once they discover you're as boring as we are, it's all over." And I think that the unknowing, like what do they do in bed? Do they hold hands? Do they sit across tables that are candlelit? Do they walk along the beach together? Do they write love letters to each other? Are they just like us? Yes, they're just like you. And in that, once you can kind of wrap your mind around that, like, it's not easy for me to picture heterosexual intercourse because it's just not a part of my heart. And I'm 60. But for me, what Gary and I do in bed, even though it's so seldom now that I'm 60 and tired, the fact is we cuddle in bed and we have long dinners together and we see each other at the airport coming home and we are intimate and loving and caring and together, and that's what makes us happy. And people should say, well, if that makes Mel and Gary happy, and if they live responsible, loving lives, and if they're spending most of their time telling people that God loves them, why do we keep fighting Mel and Gary? Why can't we simply say we don't understand Mel and Gary, but we see by their lives that they're okay? Why isn't that enough? I need to know why people feel like they have to change me after 60 years, as though I had never thought about the questions they ask.
We are talking this morning with Reverend Mel White. He is a gay activist and is the co-founder with his partner of Soul Force, which is an organization and an effort, a movement to apply the nonviolent principles that were used by men like Gandhi and Martin Luther King to the issue of sexual justice for gender minorities in this country, gay and men and lesbian women. He's here to speak as part of the Friday Forum on this very topic down on the U of I campus a little bit past noon. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can go and hear from him. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We do have a caller in Charleston, line number 4. Hello?
Yes, hello. Good program, David. I have just two comments. We have a gay friend, and he related to us the thing that he was most uncomfortable by was the fact that he couldn't do in public what other heterosexual couples do, you know, to hug or to hold hands or to demonstrate, you know, the affection for a partner, and we empathized with that. And the other comment is that Gore Vidal's comment about that homosexuality, if this was said to him, if homosexuality is not natural, and Gore's comment was, if it weren't natural, it couldn't be done. So those are my comments, and I appreciate the program in addressing those subjects. And I'll ring off. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call.
That was a great comment, the comment about when I get off an airplane and Gary's standing in the airport and I've been gone away for a week or 2 weeks or overseas, I want to hug him. And if I did, there would be people literally who would put their finger in their mouth and gag, which that's happened to us. They would throw beer bottles at us, which has happened. There's all kinds of stuff that makes this a very uneasy world for gay people to come out. And yet, see, if we don't come out, then people don't know how many of us there are. We're your neighbors, you know. We're your pastors and your priests and rabbis. We play the organs at your churches and teach your kids. I mean, we are everywhere, and yet we don't look like we're everywhere because we're afraid to be out. So it's hard. I would love to walk down the beach with Gary and hold his hand. But I know what the consequences would be. They could be dangerous as well as demeaning.
I mentioned Soul Force, and perhaps we could talk some more about what Soul Force is.
Soul Force is just the word that Gandhi used to describe his brand of militant, nonviolent resistance to injustice. It was called Satyagraha in Hindi. It meant truth force, but he always ended up talking about Soul Force because once you really start applying truth in your life and insisting that your life be true, true to itself, true to its maker, that your own soul is ennobled and renewed and empowered. So truth force was for Gandhi, soul force. And so when we realized that religion was at the heart of misunderstanding about gays and lesbians today, that religious leaders are the primary sources of toxic rhetoric against us, we realized that we had to stand up against this. We couldn't simply be acquiescent to the terrible rhetoric. And so we formed this organization. It's just simply a network of folks across the country, straight and gay alike, who want desperately to bring a peaceful, loving attitude to this discussion. And right now it's dividing churches, it's dividing homes, it's dividing families. There's some peacemaking that desperately needs to be done, and Soul Forks is simply trying to do that.
You, in all of your materials, and I know in the way you like to go about doing things, mention both Gandhi and Dr. King. And I think that there are certainly some people who make the argument that gay rights is a civil rights issue and that we ought to approach it that way. And other people reject the parallel. They say that being gay is not like being black. How do you think about that?
Well, being black and being gay is very different. But when you think about the gay black people, then you got a double jeopardy going. So it's not the same. It's very different. A gay black man might be loved by his family, his Christian family, because he's black, or even by his neighbors. But once they find out he's gay, he's on another list altogether. Dr. James Lawson, who taught Dr. King about nonviolence, James Lawson, who taught the Freedom Riders, who taught the kids who sat in at the cafeterias and the lunch counters, James Lawson, the black man that is really one of the founders of the 50s and 60s revolution, said to me the other day, it was harder to be gay for you guys than it was hard for us to be black in the 50s and 60s. And I said, wait a minute, let's not start comparing suffering. No, he says, I want to tell you why. He said, when we were in the 50s and 60s, we African Americans had our families and had our churches on our side. Gay people often don't have their families or their churches. And that means you have nowhere to go for comfort or for strength, nowhere to go for renewal and networking. And I think he's right that one of the major differences is that gay people are often rejected by very people who need to love them the most. That's sad.
We have another caller. This is Clinton, Indiana, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a friend of mine. I don't know what happened to him. This was back in the 60s. But when he was in the Navy, he said he didn't. He first discovered that he was gay. And, he was just a real nice guy. They owned a restaurant, a real exclusive type restaurant, outskirts of Chicago. And, I accepted that. You know, it didn't bother me, you know, as long as he didn't, you know, put his moves on me. But one night, he was an interior decorator, and I went to Chicago with him. And he was picking up some Italian marble and whatever have you, and he was good at his trade. Then he stopped at his friend's house. And we got up in this apartment, and it was like a hopscotch game, you know, over musical chairs. Finally, I just left and went down the car. That's the only thing I resent about that. I told him, I don't care, you know, how you feel, but he knew how I felt. But I just felt, you know, he shouldn't have tried to force that on me.
Absolutely. You were right. Nobody should force sexual intimacy on anyone, and we really agree with you. That would be very unfortunate, but we have our troublemakers, our people who aren't mature, too, and I'm sorry that happened to you.
Well, he was mature, you know. He definitely was. He's a pretty smart fella. He's, you know, just, he had the hots for me for some reason, it seemed like.
You didn't see that as a compliment?
Yeah. I liked him. I still do.
Good for you.
Okay,
thanks. Well, thanks for the call.
I'm dying to know what the hopscotch was.
I'm not sure I want to know.
It's so interesting when straight people say, you know, that gay guy had a crush on me. I found that really complimentary, but I had to tell him, you know, I'm straight. And then he said, what a waste, and went away. Just put it the opposite way, you know, when a wonderful straight woman has a crush on a gay man, and the gay man has to say, you know, I like you a lot, but that's not the way my heart beats. It's complex, but we ought to see that as very human and set standards that are high, but at the same time forgive people who, when you have a crush, man, you have a crush.
That I don't want to take anything away from the caller's experience or have, you know, cast any doubt on the way he said it was the way that it was. But why is it that we seem to have this idea that people who are gay are somehow more sexually aggressive than people who are straight?
Yeah, I don't know. There are no data to prove that. There are no data to say whether even we're more promiscuous. There has been some terrible promiscuity in heterosexual and homosexual lives, and this AIDS epidemic has pointed out to the gay community how dangerous promiscuity, meaning sex apart from any kind of commitment, or irresponsible sexual acts outside of a loving relationship. But right now, the venereal disease rates are proliferating in the heterosexual community, and that says that AIDS is in danger again of reaching that community too. I wish we would all get a hold of ourselves. Gandhi and King both talk about controlling passions as a part of doing justice, and that it's not easy. I mean, especially when you've been promiscuous. I want to say to young gay guys or to young straight guys, you know, when you've had sex a lot of different times with a lot of different people and you get that excitement going and going and going, you become addicted to that kind of excitement. And I don't care what people say. It's true. You do. And when you do settle in, then it's hard to get over that addiction. And therefore, these people are saying, wait until marriage and wait until these all things, and everybody else is laughing. I say, no way. Maybe they have something very important here. In Dallas, at our big gay church, 10,000 congregants, I was stunned because I came from Los Angeles to be the dean of that cathedral, and I found all these Texas boys in their starched jeans and their starched iron shirts refusing to have sex until they could have a wedding ceremony in the church. And that was grown-up gay men living by the same standard that I had lived under as a young kid growing up in an evangelical home. I think we had a lot more discussion about sex, heterosex and homosex, before we start really dividing over this issue. We've just kept it in the closet too long.
Yeah. How important would it be to, you think, for gay couples to be able to get married and do that in a public way, have a ceremony acknowledging this, and then have that union be recognized the way that we would recognize it if this was a heterosexual couple?
Well, there's two really important arguments. One against marriage, saying that heterosexual marriage hasn't worked for heterosexuals, that the getting married hasn't helped them much, and that's why one out of two marriages ends in divorce. That's why there's all this promiscuity in the heterosexual world. But on the other hand, a lot of us say that commitment ceremony to before your neighbors and before your community and before God and yourself is really important. That's the rite of marriage. And so we do that now. We marry gay couples and lesbian couples all the time, all across the country. And they have as good a rate, by the way, as when I was marrying heterosexual couples as a pastor. However, the rites of marriage is a different thing, are a different thing. There's 1,047 rights and protections that go automatically with heterosexual marriage that Gary and I can't have. And so when they say we're looking for special rights when we want marriage, we're not looking for special rights at all. We're looking for those basic rights that are just so important to a couple who's trying to get along in life. For example, if Gary dies, I can't even determine his burial place. His parents can do that. We have so many cases of couples that have been together 30, 40 years, and when one dies, the parents or the nearest relative of the deceased comes in and takes everything because only one person's name can be on the property or one person's name can be on the car. So when we're saying we need marriage, I don't care what you call it, but those rights and protections that go with heterosexual marriage are something we really need to support and sustain our own relationship.
Before we got going here, we talked a little bit about how you're going to be going to a meeting that the upcoming National Conference of Catholic Bishops later this month.
See, at the heart of so much misunderstanding about gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people is religious language. Baptists say we're sick and need to be cured and we're sinful and need to be saved. Methodists say we're irreconcilable with Christian teaching. Most of the mainline denominations say we're not worthy of being ordained or of being married. The Roman Catholics say that our orientation is objectively disordered and that our acts of loving intimacy are intrinsically evil. The Pope has said this year, gay people should not be allowed to be married, to adopt, to co-parent, to teach, to coach, or to serve in the military. They don't even let Dignity Catholic, that's the Solidarity Gay Catholics group in America. The Pope has even said they can't meet on church property or Dignity Catholics can't even be served the Mass by a priest. That kind of rhetoric, that kind of teaching leads parents to discard their children, leads gay bashers to harass and to hound and discriminate and against even kill gay people. So we're standing with the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. We've been writing to Bishop Forenza, who's the president of that, of all the 287 bishops in America and cardinals. And we're saying we're coming to your meeting in Washington, D.C., November 13 and 14. And by the way, coming with us are William Sloan Coffin and Arun Gandhi and James Lawson and some of the great leaders from the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s to say to you, re-examine your positions on these papers because they lead to suffering and death. I need to just read a quote from a letter of a murderer who killed gay people. The Williams brothers in Shasta County killed their employers, Gary Mattson and Winfield Mowder, a longtime gay couple. They killed them in their sleep. And in a jail interview, this man, Matthew Williams, the killer of these two gay men, said this when his mother said, "Why'd you kill those gay guys?" And he said, and this was recorded, "I had to obey God's law rather than man's law. I didn't want to do this. I felt I was supposed to. I have followed a higher law. I see a lot of parallels between this and a lot of other incidences in the Old Testament," he said about killing a gay man. "They threw our Savior in jail. Our forefathers have been in prison a lot, prophets, Christ. My brother and I are incarcerated for our work in cleansing a sick society. I just plan to defend myself from the Scriptures." We believe that that's a smoking gun. That, in fact, this kind of rhetoric from Protestant and Catholic Christianity trickles down and causes suffering and discrimination and death. And therefore, we will be standing in front. We've all adopted a bishop. We joke and say, for $10, you can adopt a cardinal. And we're writing to these bishops individually, and 287 of us, plus all our associates, will be standing with the name of our bishop in hand, saying, "Stop spiritual violence," as they assemble for their Mass in the largest Catholic church in the Americas. And we're asking only that they let Dignity Catholics in and serve them the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. That's all we're asking. And by the way, their slogan for this Jubilee year is, "Open wide the doors." And beneath that poster, they're going to have to tell us either to come in, which will be breaking their own law, or stay out, which won't even make sense to people looking on. And if they don't let us in, we're going to jail, and we're going to stay in jail until they meet with us and seriously consider the damage they're doing. Hmm.
One can imagine that what they might do would be to respond to your concerns on one level by saying, of course, we condemn violence against gay men and lesbian women. We would never, ever say that, not the slightest shred of approval for an act like that, but then at the same time hold to the other things that they would say, basically saying that they think that homosexuality is a sin.
Oh, definitely. They are against violence. I think genuinely against violence. I don't think they realize how much they contribute to violence while they're saying that. When Jerry Falwell says that gay men and women are a threat to American values, that they abuse and recruit and molest children, that they have earthquakes in California because there's so many gays in San Francisco, and that, you know, this and this and this and this. The Catholic Church saying that we're intrinsically evil and that we shouldn't do all these things implies the very same thing. So I don't see the Pope as being very different from Jerry Falwell or the Ayatollah in terms of the way they stand towards gay people. A wonderful rabbi, Rabbi Abraham Heschel, said, "Words have power. Speech does not fade. What starts as a sound ends in a deed." And if you're sitting in that church pew hearing week after week after week after week that gay people threaten our children, that they shouldn't coach because they will molest our children, assumed. They shouldn't serve in the military because they will molest their buddies, even though the data shows totally different data on that. That they shouldn't be this and they shouldn't do that and they can't do this and they're sick and they're sinful. You hear that enough and you go out and bash a gay person, you feel like you're doing God a service. So you can't say we love the sinner but hate the sin. You either love us as we are or you don't love us at all.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Perhaps I should introduce our guest again for anyone who's tuned in the last little bit here. We're speaking with Reverend Mel White. He is a gay activist. And he is co-founder of this organization we've mentioned called Soul Force, which is interested in applying the classic nonviolence principles advocated by Gandhi and Martin Luther King toward the issue of justice for sexual gender minorities. Questions, comments, welcome. Certainly 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I mentioned at the beginning of the program that you had had this long association with the evangelical Christian community and with people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and that at the time that you came out in a very public way, that your story got a lot of attention. And I can imagine some people saying, well, this is just another example of the liberal media seizing on an opportunity to poke the finger in the eye of conservatives in this country or the religious right or so forth. And I wonder what you think about the kind of coverage that you and your story got, and whether you thought they got the issues right, or that media were attracted to the story primarily because it was about conflict and also because it was about conflict on the political right in this country.
Without the media right now, I don't think these issues would be as far along as they are. I think 60 Minutes and Larry King and all these programs that we were on were really trying to get at the heart of this issue. I happen to be larger than life because of my relationship with Dr. Graham and all these folks. And so they use me as a larger than life symbol, but that's kind of the media. My son is now a writer on Dawson's Creek, which is a popular kids program. And he just wrote a program about undifferentiated genitalia for a new program called Freaks and Geeks. He's struggling like mad to make these issues come to life for people in a loving way. And so for me, the media has not been one-sided. The media is taking a terrible beating from a lot of my evangelical friends for being only on the liberal side, only on the liberal side. But for me, I've been beaten down by the media as much as I've been elevated by it. I've had times of really crucifixion on the media as well as times of being crowned king of the emperor, you know. And at this point, I don't know. I think the media is pretty well-rounded. I hate going on radio or television anymore because there's so many people who just want to say, have you read Romans 1? Have you read Leviticus 20? I was on the program the other day with a Presbyterian minister who had, have you ever read Leviticus 20? I said, yes, sir, I've read it. What does it mean to you? And he says, you should be killed.
And you know, he actually came right out and said
50,000-watt radio station in Seattle, Presbyterian minister. And that's what it says. The Leviticus text says a man who sleeps with another man is an abomination and should be executed. That's what it means. King James softened a little bit, said by saying it worthy of death. But when you study the Hebrew, it should be executed. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, who should do the killing, you church folks? And he said, no, no, no. That's the civil authority's job. That's why we need to get more good men of God elected into government. And I'm sitting there, I can't even speak. And this Rush Limbaugh kind of host who was there with me was kind of stunned too. And in the silence, this Presbyterian says, well, I know this must be hard for you to hear, Dr. White, but God said it first, and it's just our job to obey. There's a lot of that kind of talk out there, talk about spiritual violence. And when people hear that, this is one of the letters I got just a few days ago from a kid. He said, Dear Mel, I'm so scared and so confused. I don't know what to do or who to believe anymore. Sometimes I wish that I wasn't gay at all. Life would be much easier then. I wish that Jesus and God would have made the subject of homosexuality clear in the Bible. Didn't God realize people would use and abuse this subject? It's not very clear. I wish that I could just give up on God and religion, but I can't. I live to please God. I've run out of answers, and the next step I take will be a gigantic leap. Sometimes I wish that I could just die or be castrated. Then this nightmare would end. I tell you, whatever you think about homosexuality, there's real people suffering. 7 times more likely to commit suicide is a gay teenager than a straight teenager. Why are they doing that? Why have I had to bury so many gay kids who kill themselves, bright and wonderful, because their parents condemn them, their churches condemn them, their schoolmates condemn them? And this all flows out of kind of religion and its misunderstanding. So for me, this is not an issue that you can be too liberal about. This is an issue. We've got to do something to save the kids.
Well, let's talk with some other folks. We have a caller here in Salem. That's line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Well, if I may just mention a few of these ideas that have been going in my head, and then I'll just hang up and see what you have to say. But, I mean, I believe it's God's universe and God's laws, and that we are in a kind of discovery state, and that God wants us what's best and what's happy. You know, wants people to do what's best and be happy, but he gives us choice. Now, on one program, they had a surgeon that described the when he operates that the body is like a factory. You know, and when you think about the fact, you know, trying to, our bodies are trying to promote health and, you know, recover from illness, and they, our bodies want life. So then, when you, this is a hodgepodge, I know, but you know, trying to be objective, like I see that sex is for procreation. You know, when you look at animals, you know, their whole goal is to, you know, create offspring and promote the, you know, the next generation, so to speak. But sex has become an addiction in our culture. And, I mean, there are just so many things open for question. You know, in the Old Testament, men could have 4 wives. So if you open everything for question. But, you know, as you said, things are choice, and, you know, there's choice, and choices can become addiction. And then the way the society organizes itself, like I understand the Muslims, their world is organized that way, you know, wearing dark clothes and everything, because they realize the power of sex. And then there's people in yoga who use that to try to, you know, calm themselves. So it's, you know, it depends what your goal in is life, you know. Now, anyway, that's kind of hodgepodge, but I'll hang up and see what you say.
Okay.
Thank you.
I guess what I come away with from what the caller says, and I think that, you know, various times and places people have believed this, that it reflects the feeling that sex is dangerous. Sex is a very dangerous thing. Sexual passion is a very dangerous thing. And I think it's true that in some way we... And maybe this is just something that's in Christianity. I'm not sure about other faiths. I think there is a suspicion of the idea and a distrust of the idea that sex can be just for pleasure. And that sexual activities that can't lead to making babies, there again, there's something wrong with that.
Absolutely. That's been church teaching from the beginning of time, that and a church assumption, if not teaching. And in my case, of course, I had 2 wonderful children, so I did my part, and now I'm not a threat to society because the generations go on, if that's a kind of joke for me. The fact is we need more people like we need a hole in the head right now. that gay people should be seen as saviors if they're not going to. The irony is that gay people are having children too and adopting children, adopting these AIDS babies. The gay people have often the same parental instincts that heterosexual often have. And so I love the way lesbians are adopting kids from all over the world who are unwanted. Lesbians are having children by artificial insemination. Gay men are having children with a surrogate mother. These are responsible, caring people who love parenting and who are doing their job. But in terms of sexual intimacy as being a source of pleasure, we need to get over that fear, but we need to contain it. Like you said, the passions are really important to us and give us life and joy. And it's a gift from God to be sexual. I just wish I had more energy for it.
So the other thing that, and I don't mean to put words in the caller's mouth, and I don't know if this is what she was suggesting or not, but I guess also that there are some people who would say, I'm okay with you being gay. Would you just not act gay? Could you do that? Right. Could you do that for me?
I understand that. They say be celibate. Exactly. Just be celibate. Yes. You guys can live together, but don't touch each other privately or intimately. I understand that. But, you know, celibacy is a studied science. It's a gift. Some people have and some people don't. And the Catholic Church has pushed it for a long time, and we already know where that goes. They spent $2 billion in the last 10 years just settling class action suits against them for priests that couldn't be celibate. When I speak at a university, I often say to a great, like 5,000 people, how many of you have ever masturbated? And nobody raises his hand. And then everybody laughs. Because we in America don't want to talk about these issues, sex as pleasure or sex as procreation at all, let alone homosex. And so for me, your program is very important. That we just start saying, you know, you young people are still struggling with masturbation as though it were bad. It's not bad. It's something that we all do. You know, you people who want sexual intimacy, it's a natural need to want that sexual intimacy for procreation, for other reasons. Just to talk about it, to see it in its beautiful creation context, and to build then ideology that backs it up and supports it. Man, I tell you, we could become so much more positive about sex than we are. Of course, then there's the movies, but don't go there.
Another caller here. This is Champagne. It's line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
When I was very small, about 3 or 4, I played with a neighbor boy, and I knew he was a little different. He liked the things that I liked. So, and way back then, of course, his mother got blamed for the fact that he was a little different. So I've known ever since then that homosexuality is not a choice. He didn't choose to be homosexual, and his mother didn't. So it's real hard for me to understand the discrimination it has been all these years. Well, that's all I have to say.
Oh, okay. I love you. Can we make you a saint?
Do you have saints in your church?
Yeah, we will now. What's her name?
My name?
No, we don't require people to give their names. better stay anonymous.
Okay.
Thanks
Bye.
For the call. This gets at another question. And I think maybe people within the gay community actually are a little bit divided on this issue, whether it would be better or not to be able to establish without any sort of a doubt that a person's born gay. We could say, you know, we could do something and we could point to their brain, or we could point to something in the way of the person's development or so far. So we could say without any doubt, and it's not a matter of choice, being gay is just what you are. And I think within the gay community, there are some people, you know, some people would say, you know, that would be a good thing. And others would say, no, that's not the issue. That's sort of beside the point.
Scientific discovery is always good. If we can move forward into that realm and find out what's true, it's important, whether we like it or not. The reason people don't like it is they're afraid people will change it. Once they discover the gay gene, they'll kill it or they'll manipulate it. And gay people throughout the ages have been really important to culture, and it would be a terrible thing to lose that wonderful quality. So I think people are afraid of it. Simon LeVay, a great scientist, said to me the other day, it's probably so difficult to know how you become gay, how sexual orientation is decided, both in prenatal and postnatal, both by nature and by nurture. And he says, you know, I don't know much about God, but I think the Creator really wanted it to be complex so they couldn't change it. And so he says the only gay gene is Calvin Klein. By the way, this and a lot of other things are on our website at www.soulforce.org. And if people are interested in going to Washington, D.C. with us and standing and confronting this Catholic teaching, do go to www.soulforce.org and see what we're doing and maybe join up.
We'll try to get, we have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get one more. The first person here in line one in Champaign. Hello?
Yes, I want to change gears just a little bit. And this is an honest question. Are the gays not pretty much behind the hate crime legislation that's coming up a lot now? And is Mr. White comfortable with the courts judging the motives of people? I'll hang up and listen.
I think all crimes are hate crimes. And so on that point, I really agree with you. I think some of the motive behind hate crime legislation is to say that there are certain penalties that need to be imposed when someone kills a Jew for being Jewish, or kills a Muslim for being a Muslim, or kills a gay for being gay, or a black person for being black, that they simply include those hate crimes in that legislation, which often gives more finances to the chase, more definition to the law. So I don't know. I'm mixed on that. I just wish we would stop hating anybody, and I don't know quite how to do that. So I vote for the hate crime legislation as a way of at least keeping this discussion going.
Hmm. Well, we're going to have to stop at this point because we have used the time. For anyone who is here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you're certainly welcome to hear our guest, the Reverend Mel White. He'll be speaking today at the Friday Forum. This is at the University of Y on South Wright. Down on the campus, a little bit past noon, he'll be there. So anyone is invited. It's free and open to the public. And we want to say to you, Reverend White, thank you very much.
You're welcome. For being here.